I didn't see the movie, but one of our chat, Josh, says Jeremy again with the food recommend.
Oh my god.
Oh no. Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Fates intertwined, cosmic coincidence, you know.
You're full of shit.
All that crap. I'm full of shit. You're a monument of it. You even bullshitted yourself. All I am is taking out the garbage, killing bad people.
Well, that's what you said.
You believe me?
Hello, everybody. It is Wreckatopia episode 98. Today's big recommend will be Collateral. I'm joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hey, that's me.
And Jeremy Scott.
That's you.
And I'm Chris Atkinson. Hey, that's me. And welcome chat for coming in here today. Thank you guys for coming in. And chat's already lively and everybody's saying hello and good morning and I'm having my coffee and all that other type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And all that. Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that type of stuff. Anyway, anybody have any small recommends to kick us off?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
Mm-hmm. I will start.
Do it.
I will start with a brand new film on Netflix called Society of the Snow, directed by J.A. Bayona. Who has had an interesting career. He directed The Orphanage and A Monster Calls, but he also directed Jurassic World, Fallen, whatever, Order. while prepping for this, I looked him up. He's 9 days older than me, which means he's like 15 days older than Dice or something. Like
right, yes.
And, you know, comparing that to my own accomplishments, he's made a lot more films than I have. This is a new film about the story you've probably heard before of the rugby team from Uruguay that crashes in the Andes Mountains on their way to Chile. There was a film called Alive back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Ethan Hawke was in it, this Society of the Snow is going for a much more realistic take. There are no Hollywood stars in this. Most of these guys are unknowns and or first time actors, guys and girls. It's all in Spanish, and it's so realistic that I don't know that I will ever watch it again. This is not like Requiem for a Dream, where I say it's great, but I never want to see it again, but you don't necessarily need to see it. I kind of feel like this is one of those films people need to see, because it is hugely inspiring as much as it is harrowing. The plane crash is the most frightening plane crash I've ever seen in a movie ever. I was watching it like this. Literally had my arm over my mouth. If you are concerned, and you should be, look up Does the Dog Die for any triggers you might have. If you know a little bit about the story, you know some of the awful things they had to do to survive. It is just a home run of a film, in my opinion, and I hope that it gets some awards acknowledgement. So there you go. It's on Netflix. Mm-hmm. Brand new, 90 on Rotten Tomatoes, 7.9 on IMDb, which is high for IMDb. Mm-hmm. And I loved it, but I may never watch it again.
I agree. It's kind of like United 93 in that way, right? Where it's just like this important, inspirational movie that you just don't, you know, like it's just hard to watch. And this one is like that as well. Unless Chris doesn't think so. Chris,
chat, Josh, says Jeremy again with the food recommend.
Oh no, I wondered why you were laughing when I mentioned United 93.
No. I was not paying attention. Okay. So that laugh
That's completely understandable. Completely understandable. Josh Zero just ending the podcast with that comment. Just amazing. I second Jeremy's thoughts on this and to encourage a watch. It does everything Alive does better. because it feels more authentic. It feels more real. It feels less Hollywood-y. It corrects a lot of the mistakes that movie made in casting.
I'm telling you right now, I would be one of those people that just fell asleep and died the first night. I would not last in this situation.
Yeah.
And what it takes for them to do it is, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's wild. Possibly the greatest survival story of all time. It's pretty impressive. So, yeah.
All right, Aaron.
My small recommend is a Studio Ghibli film called Only Yesterday. This is 1991. I'd never even heard of this before, but I've been trying to get a little more into that studio stuff and kind of go through in order the stuff that they're doing or have done. Isayo Takahata, I'm going to say. I could be completely wrong. I apologize if I am. Wrote and directed this. This is his follow-up to Grave of the Fireflies, which I think I've talked about previously on the show.
It's a great movie.
This is also a great movie. I was blown away by this movie. In fact, I'm really blown away that it was a dude that wrote and directed this, because it feels so, there's an authentically, in my opinion, again, I'm a man as well, so maybe it's not, but it feels like an authentically female story here, coming of age where a woman who is in her 20s is nostalgic for the memories of her youth, but then also remembering the trauma and the different things that happened and how it's informing who she is today. It's pretty impressive emotional work. I was engaged the entire time just in who this woman is, how she became that way. Some of the childhood stuff is just, it's that childhood stuff where you're just like, oh, I remember, like, it makes you remember being a kid and what it felt like to be confused or in awe of things, or it's just really empathetic work, and I really enjoy this movie. So I wanted to throw it on people's awareness pile because it was not on my awareness pile at all.
Yeah, those movies seem to slip through the cracks a lot of times. Like I had never heard of Graveyard of the Fireflies until like I looked at the IMDb top 100 one time, and I was like, "What the hell is this?" And it was really hard to find that movie too. So like, you know, but all these movies seem to slip. I've never heard of this movie. So
yeah, I hadn't either.
So yeah, there's a lot on my list as well that I still need to see.
I recently got a Studio Ghibli like box set that has like all of their movies. So that's kind of how I've been working through. Nice. I would highly recommend it. It's a great work through. So yeah.
Yeah.
How many of them are in that set?
Oh, I don't remember. It's a lot.
I was going to say lots and lots.
Yeah.
Lots and lots. Chris, did you have any small recommends?
I did. The Holdovers. Alexander Payne's not so new one now at this point. I watched this probably a month and a half ago, somewhere around there. But this stars Paul Giamatti, who's always great and who's always, I feel like, going to be underrepresented by Oscar nominations and awards for his work in all sorts of things. I think he still to this day has only been nominated one time, and that was Cinderella Man, which is just hard to believe considering what he has done over his career. But this is about a private school where he's not a very popular teacher whatsoever. People hate taking his classes, and because he does something that offends the head principal guy of the school, he is made to be the guy who has to stay for Christmas vacation and basically babysit for kids who have been left behind or can't go home for the whatever reason, or there's all sorts of different reasons. It's like six or seven kids who get left behind. So he has to do that duty. One of the kids, played by a newcomer, his name is Dominic Sessa, he has his plans for Christmas. He's going to go to this, like, you know, island or something, this tropical paradise or something. And those plans fall through, and this is after he's bragged to everybody where he's going and all of that, and then he finds out, oh, now I'm going to have to stay here, and he can't get in contact with his parents, and so, like, and also at the last minute, this other kid's parents comes in and says, I'm paying for a ski trip for everybody as long as you get your parents' permission.
And so
like all these other kids get to go on a ski trip while he can't get a hold of his parents for any reason. So most of the movie is Paul Giamatti and Dominic Sessa in the school and interacting and, you know, having this like, you know, hate relationship and everything. But if you know movies, you know that this starts to warm over a little bit as they get to understand each other a little bit more throughout the picture. Another adult in this picture, played by Divine Joy Randolph, you may have seen in Only Murders in the Building and stuff like that. Also great in this movie. She plays a woman whose son who's been killed in Vietnam, and she's still struggling with it. This movie's set in the like 1970 or something like that. So, typical great Alexander Payne stuff here. And if you were a fan of especially something like Sideways, which I think goes along well with this movie because of the Giamatti connection and the Payne connection, I think you'll really, really love this one too. So
good. Giamatti won a Golden Globe last night, and there's a photo going around social media of him sitting at In-N-Out Burger in his tux with the Golden Globe sitting on the table. And it reminds me of that scene in Sideways at the end where he takes his fancy bottle of wine to some fast food joint and sits there quietly eating it.
Anyway. I thought that's a purposeful reference, right? Like that was, he did that purposefully to imitate that. That's so perfect, right? Like, that's so perfect.
I've seen plenty of golfers will win the Masters and then do something totally normal with the green jacket on, like go to McDonald's or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it could be a reference to that. And it's amazing. I mean, he obviously liked working with Alexander Payne.
I have, this is my vote this year for a movie I would be absolutely shocked if Jeremy didn't absolutely love. This movie is going to be, it will be shocking to me if you don't enjoy this, Jeremy. It's so fun. It's so interesting. Divine Joy Randolph is almost a lock to win the Oscar for this.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, she's the front runner for Best Supporting Actress. So it's really good. I love, you mentioned the ski trip thing. I love how this movie isn't afraid. Like, it almost sets it up like, oh, here's all the buddies and we're going to get to know this group. And then all of a sudden it's like, nope, they're all gone. And this is really about these two. And it's, I love that. It feels almost brave, because in most movies now, like every character has to have an arc. Every character is with us from beginning to end. And this movie's like, no, we're going to focus on where the story wants us to focus. And I just think it really benefits from that.
And yes, I saw the question by Flyboy that's way up on the chat now that asked, he didn't get nominated for Sideways. No, he did not get nominated for Sideways.
No, he did not.
That's the point. Like, he just, there's so many, like American Splendor is one he should have been nominated for and didn't. Sideways is one. For
Private Parts. God, he could have been
nominated. Yeah, for Private Parts, which was one of his first movie, like first big role movies anyway. But anyway. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're on our big recommend, which is Collateral, and it's Jeremy's. So take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Oh, shit. This was my recommend. I'm just kidding. I had not seen Collateral in many years, probably 7 or 8 years. And boy, did I have fun watching this movie again. Michael Mann absolutely owns LA at night. There's nobody that can shoot that city at night with mood and action and character development. I came away with even more appreciation for his directing style. We open with Tom Cruise, whose name is Vincent, also played a character named Vincent in Color of Money. There's your trivia for the day. He's at an airport and he bumps into Jason Statham, and they both drop their bags and pick up the other person's bag. And talk about characters that stay with us from beginning to end of the movie. Jason Statham is not one of them. He is gone after this. I was confused. I had to go check. And he was certainly famous and starring in movies at this point. So this is either a favor or a cameo or a happy little coincidence. But Jason Statham is obviously giving Vincent some stuff he couldn't take on the plane. I wonder what it could be. Then we cut over to Max, the cabbie, Jamie Foxx. Jamie Foxx spells his name with two X's, and I found myself in my notes spelling Max with two X's for about half the movie before I realized what I was doing.
This is his first of two Maxes, because he plays Max in Amazing Spider-Man.
He does. And, then later in No Way Home. So he's coming on the evening shift for a taxi company. You can tell he's a little bit of a clean freak because he Windexes the dash and the the steering wheel, although I would do that too if I shared a cab with any other drivers. He takes a little postcard of a tropical island and puts it in the visor, and we will see him later look at that for moments of peace and zen when his customers, like Sherilyn, I think it's Sherilyn Fenn, get too obnoxious. And one of his first passengers he picks up is Jada Pinkett, and we'll find out
later. Actually, that was Debbie Mazar.
Debbie Mazar, not Sherilyn Fenn. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. There's always, every generation has two actors, female or male, that I get
confused. Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if it's a direct reference, but she bosses him around on what route to take, exactly like Holly Hunter does in Broadcast News. Like,
oh, yeah.
Take this, take the five, then take it over to this, then take Garden down. And it's just hilarious to me. And maybe that's just a common taxi passenger, and that's why it ends up in multiple movies, but it felt like a reference. Yeah. He thinks there's a better route, though. And so they make a playful bet on it. And he, of course, ends up being right. I would never bet against a cabbie on what route is fastest, no matter how much time I've spent in a city. That's just dumb. he's right. They get there faster, and she's impressed. And he tells her a story about how he's just driving this cab till he can get his own limo company up and running. And as they part, he gives her his island postcard, so she can take a mental vacation, because she basically admits to him that she's terrified every time before a big trial. And she's touched by that and gives him her business card. This will be important later. the next passenger he picks up immediately is Vincent, and Max almost misses him by just not realizing he's outside the door. And this is one of 15 massive coincidences that will happen in this movie. Mm-hmm. But I don't mind. If we were sinning this movie, we would be racking up a score.
There's at least one that I was thinking, oh, come on. But then I realized, you know, this actually could happen, but there's several others in there that they can't. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
So Vincent does get in Max's cab after Max is like, no, I'm good. And pretty quickly tells him he's got five stops to make for a real estate deal. And then he's going back to LAX to fly out on red eye. And he offers $700 to Max to drive him around all night. And despite the fact that this is against the rules, Max says okay, because, hey, $700. I think all of us would accept this in this instant. Vincent gets out at the first stop and says, meet me in the alley behind the building. Then promptly goes upstairs and throws somebody out a glass window onto the taxi. Max is, understandably wigged the fuck out by this and tries to leave. But Vincent pulls a gun and forces him to help him move the body into the trunk. And it's at this point, after they take off, that we meet Mark Ruffalo. And Mark Ruffalo is a cop. He shows up to this apartment where the body was just thrown out the window. And there's obviously a crime that has happened, but there is no body. There is some blood and glass on the ground, and he calls for other detectives and backup. Next, we see Max and Vincent again, and Max is freaking out, but Vincent is basically saying, you know, I'll kill you if you don't help me, so help me. And then they get pulled over by cops. And I don't know that this is a coincidence, but it is a huge favor from the universe that right as the cops are about to make him open the trunk, they get called to a more important call.
One of the big ones.
That's a big, big one. Because Vincent is saying to him, if they open that trunk, they're going inside. And what I love about this Vincent character, the way he's written and the way he's played, is he pegs Max's character immediately as a man of conscience, a man who can be manipulated based on his conscience and morality. This is a guy who doesn't want to see any innocent people die, even these cops. But the cops get called away. Hooray. They are able to continue on to the next stop. While Vincent is up murdering victim number two in a penthouse, he zip ties Max to the steering wheel. Max honks and flashes the lights. This is the most realistic part of the movie, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. People who see him flashing the lights are not coming to help him. They're bad people who want to harm him and steal shit. And he is, of course, zip tied to the steering wheel and can't help. But Vincent arrives just in time. And in a very cool scene, kills the bad guys. And I have a note from IMDb that I found during research that apparently this scene, like Tom Cruise's gun handling, is so good that they use it to train cops. Mm-hmm. And that does not surprise me, because we know now that Tom Cruise is a guy who throws himself into learning how to do things to be as authentic as possible. I doubt he actually killed people. But I wouldn't put it past him.
You don't know.
And back with the cops, Peter Berg is here now. They find a casing in the apartment. And Ruffalo remembers a story about a night of killings in Oakland where a cabbie went around killing a bunch of different people. But some cops always thought there was another person in the car giving those orders. Dun, dun, dun. Mm-hmm. Vincent takes Max to a jazz club. This is one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie. Mm-hmm. He basically says, we've got extra time. Let's go listen to jazz. Do you like jazz? And Max is like, no. And so they listen to a little bit of jazz. And Vincent is so impressed with one of the players, he asks the waitress, hey, can you have this guy come over and I'll buy him a drink when the set is done? And it's, you know, played like this is just this classic jazz guy who, well, he even tells a story about playing with Miles Davis for 20 minutes on stage. And Vincent is awed by this story and then drops a casual line like, I wish I could tell this story to the men in two C-name cities. I don't remember. Cartagena, I don't remember.
Cartagena is one of them.
Is it? Oh, awesome. That is clearly a signal as the jazz man's face goes dead. And he repeats the cities. And basically realizes he's about to be killed and then begs for his life, says, I'll run away. You'll never hear from me again. And Max says, okay, or Vincent says, okay, we'll do a trivia question. If you get it right, I'll let you go. If not, and he asks him where Miles Davis learned to play jazz. And the guy says, well, everybody knows that. He went to Juilliard at age whatever. And Vincent immediately shoots the dude in the head. And Max, understandably, wigs out. There have been killings tonight, but none were right in front of him, 2 feet from his face. And Vincent will later tell us and Max that the actual answer to the question was that he dropped out of Juilliard after a few months and learned everything from...
Charlie Parker.
Thank you, Charlie Parker. All right. So... they have now killed 3 of the 5 victims, but the cabbie's boss is calling him incessantly. So he gets on the radio, and the cabbie's boss says, your mom won't stop calling me. She's calling me every 10 minutes. Why didn't you show up, she says. And Vincent says, wait, you visit your mom in the hospital every night? And Max is like, yes. It's like, then we got to do it, because we can't have any out-of-the-ordinary things happening tonight, even though everything he's making Max do is out of the ordinary tonight. He's not picking up fares. He's not talking on the radio to his bosses. But this one thing. Gotta go see your mom in the hospital. Doesn't make tons of sense to me, but I don't care because it's a pretty cool scene. They end up actually sharing an elevator with Ruffalo's character, who I believe is named Fanning.
Yeah.
While Vincent is talking to Max's mom, charming her, Max idiotically grabs Vincent's briefcase and bolts. There's a foot chase because Tom Cruise always has to run. Yep. And they end up on this sidewalk overpass over the highway, and Max throws the briefcase over where it's destroyed by a passing semi. And that was dumb. We cut over to the morgue, and Ruffalo is shown multiple bodies dispatched execution style and finds the body of a lawyer who is a criminal connected to the first crime scene's victim. So now the cops are starting to put the pieces together. Vince has Max taken to a place to meet Felix, who's connected with the people that hired Vincent, and basically says, because you threw all my stuff away, I'm going to make you go in there and pretend to be me to get backup copies for the last two victims. And he does, surprisingly. But we also find out here that there are law enforcement people surveilling this club that Felix is in. they see him go in. They even spot the taxi after Ruffalo shows up. They spot the damage on the taxi. They grab the license plate for the taxi. So things are going to get hot, hot, hot. Inside, Max is finding some kind of inner will and drama training from high school. And I suppose this is all adrenaline. But he actually turns into the guy he needs to be for about 30 or 40 seconds. Mm-hmm. Shows some confidence and is able to get the backup files on a thumb drive. But by now, the cops have analyzed audio of him entering, calling himself Vincent, and they have figured out the next possible target. And there are air and land units headed to the same place as Max. It's a club called Fever. and this is a pretty cool scene. The guys that Vincent hired, or the guys that hired Vincent, are also on their way to the club, so that if Vincent messes up, they will kill him. But don't forget, they think that Max is Vincent. It's all very convoluted. Before they get to the club, Max and Vincent have an incredibly symbolic encounter with a lone coyote. And then they move on to the club. The club scene is absolute chaos, but it's chaos that, from a filmmaking standpoint, is controlled. Even though you don't know where everyone is precisely at all times, you know enough to know enough. And Vincent gives Max instructions to use him as a decoy, sends him out on the floor, and then slowly starts taking out the private guards of this witness that he's trying to kill. And then he assassinates the witness. Fanning, that's Ruffalo's character, finally realizes that Max isn't Vincent and walks him outside to safety, only to be immediately assassinated by Vincent in one of the more shocking moments of the film.
Mm-hmm.
He forces Max back in the cab. They take off, but now there are multiple helicopters in the air looking for them. They bicker in the car, and eventually Max is convinced by Vincent's philosophy of life that nothing really matters and intentionally wrecks the car so that he can get away. He does crash the taxi, but Vincent runs away, and a single cop shows up, and he's super helpful at first. He's like, "No, dude, you've been in a car accident. Sit down, relax." And then as he's checking out the car, he sees the body in the trunk, now that the trunk has been popped partially open by the accident, and starts trying to arrest Max. But in another of the biggest coincidences of my lifetime, as Max is about to be handcuffed, he looks into the crashed taxi and sees that Vincent's files have spilled, and there is the name and photo of the next victim. And not only that, it's Jada Pinkett from the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Not her phone number. So he overpowers the cop, grabs a gun. He repeats Vincent's line here from earlier, telling the cop, "When did this become a negotiation?" And I think that's pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And then he can't get a phone signal. This is 2004, so I'm willing to forgive cell phone signal issues because they were real back then. And he ends up in a parking garage, climbing to the top, and he's actually at the foot of the law building that Jada Pinkett is in, and he finally gets a signal and he calls her, and we're intercutting now between him trying to warn her and Vincent entering the building using the swipe keys that he got somehow from, I don't know, and stalking her. And this is a classic movie thing here where he arrives at the office before she's had time to go anywhere, only for us to find out she's not currently in her office. She's two floors up in the law library. And so first Max is like, "Well, just stay there. He doesn't know you're there." But he starts to lose his battery on his cell phone, of course, and the calls keep dropping. And then Vincent, who is smarter than anyone else in this whole movie, looks down and sees the lit line on the phone and realizes that somebody is somewhere in this building on the phone, and he knows it's her. And he, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he can deduce from the phone light what floor she's on.
There's a label underneath the light that says 14th floor.
Okay, so he starts looking up. And then Max finally gets back through to her and says, "He knows you're there now. Oh, crap, I was wrong. He knows you're there now." But the phone dies, and there's no choice but for Max to run in there and try and save her. Max shows up just as Vincent finds her and shoots Vincent and runs off with the lawyer. But then there's a chase because, of course, Vincent isn't dead. There's an awesome moment where Vincent throws an office chair through a pane of glass and then goes to jump over it, but actually lands on it and falls awkwardly over to the side. And I did read that that was a complete accident that the director loved, so they kept it in, which I think is awesome. They take the elevator down. Vincent takes the stairs. I'm not sure what's going on there. And also Vincent has like a weird ability to know which direction they went. But he follows them. They end up at the subway, and I need your guys' help here because they go down to the subway main floor. They look at a track where there's a train, and then Max looks down, and there's a second subfloor, and they go down there. Vincent comes in at the same staircase and ends up not going downstairs and going straight across and jumping a track, and then somehow they're all on the same train. And I don't know if the movie is saying Max and the lawyer went back up the stairs on the other side, and that's why they were crawling on their hands and knees to get into the train on the main platform. I got a little confused with the editing there.
That's one thing I did not notice, so I have no idea. It could also be just saying that since they're on the second floor, we just assume Vincent went down to the second floor as well. They just didn't show us.
Yeah,
so going down the second flight or something like that.
They didn't show us that we're supposed to assume.
Yeah, there's something cat and mouse going on there, like extra, you know, sensory perception from Cruz's character to get to the right train that they're trying to do. I didn't quite follow it either. So,
okay. Anyway, they see him coming. They take off to the front of the subway car. There's a pretty awesome moment where the train stops at a station and the doors open, and they're kind of hidden from him right now. But Vincent steps outside the train and just basically waits for them to pop their head out.
It's a very French Connection kind of homage. I mean, it's a little bit different from what French Connection does, but it still gives you the reminder.
Yeah, and so they stay on the train, and the doors close, and he creeps closer and closer, and then, power of lights going off at the right time leads to a shootout where Max doesn't get hit and Vincent gets hit. It's wild. And then Vincent struggles a little bit, sits down, and then he references a story he told earlier about a man dying on the MTA and it taking days before anyone ever noticed, mm-hmm. and asks if anyone will notice him. And then he dies. And we do see the lawyer and Max walking a bit. But.
And that's how the movie ends, which is, to me, like, there's so much more left after this. Like, how does he explain this to anybody? You yes. know,
yes.
he's still going to be wanted for murder.
Yes.
After this,
he still has a lot of splaining to do, for sure.
Yes.
All right, Aaron, Chris, what are your guys' thoughts this time through on Collateral?
I love Collateral. Exactly what you were talking about. Michael Mann and L.A. is a really good combo. You know, if you've seen Heat, then you're gonna. This is like the more actiony version of Heat, where it's not. It doesn't have a lot of long. The only long conversation is the jazz club, and that's such an interesting. Thing that Heat's got a lot of those like very ponderous conversations, and you're like you could fall asleep to it, but yeah. They're that way. But this movie's always constantly moving. I think it's funny the coincidence of him not only seeing that Jada Pinkett is his next victim is one thing, but also I don't know if you're a drug cartel, what killing the prosecutor is going to do in this situation.
Yeah.
It's not like if you kill her, the case goes away. There'll be other lawyers that come up afterwards. That's the point of these big cases.
Whereas
after that.
The witnesses, those, once they die, they're gone. They're gone.
Witnesses make sense. Totally makes sense. I also never really understood. Maybe he explains this. I never really understood why Vincent needs the cab this whole time. Maybe he needs somebody who knows LA and he can get around fast and all that. Maybe that's the point.
I think so.
But I think if you're a professional and I think if you're a professional, you would know kind of like how to get to places if you need to. I mean, as you said, he seems to know where all these guys were. Jamie Foxx is at any time. So
yep.
If he's got that kind of like heat seeking ability, then, you would think that. So I never really understood that. And of course the keeping of the body in the trunk is a massive convenience for later. So that the big thing, that big, crash and cop discovers it thing happens and everything. Cause I don't, if you're storing a body in the trunk and you're worried that people might gonna find it, there's a number of people who could be seeing you right now do that. So why don't I just move the body somewhere out of
the, what's the
that
guy and, the guy they didn't, none of the other victims go in the trunk. He doesn't hide any of the other bodies.
So right. I think partially what we're supposed to believe is that Max is the what's the word I'm looking for, he's framing Max. So the body in the trunk is one way to make sure that Max is connected to all of these crimes and at the end of the
that
day.
That makes sense.
Well, so I think he's purposefully doing that.
Then don't throw him on top of the cab and make him a cop magnet throughout the rest of the
Well, and he explains that away by saying he shot him and it was the bullet in the fall is what killed him. So
yeah.
I think he's trying to say he didn't throw him out, but he shot him in front of the window and the guy staggered back and fell out. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think that there's anything other than you pointing a gun at his head that makes anything. I mean, like, yeah, you can frame him, but who's going to be looking for you anyway? I don't think that. I think that's still a plot device. I still think it's just a way to make things more on edge when they don't need to be.
So some of what I read from Mann was that the Vincent character, it very purposefully picks the Fox character as the, and Patsy was the word I was looking for, and the chat came through with that. Thank you for that. As the Patsy in this, and that even the Jada Pinkett Smith thing is not a coincidence. That's purposeful, that cabbie gave her a ride already, and he was tracking, that to have that in, be part of the evidence and part of the suspect.
But he wasn't. He almost didn't get into that cab.
Yeah. And then the other thing was that Mann said was something about there's something early on where he says something to the Jamie Foxx character to see how aggressive he will be, so he knows if he will go along with, you know, everything on the night. So there's some framework laid there. I don't know that it's well executed. I think
I think I'll settle on that. Like that's what they were going for, but I don't think it supports the weight of it. But
correct.
The one thing I do like about this, and I saw a comment earlier, like, you know, that said, you know, this is the perfect scenario for a protagonist to be, you know, to have an antagonist come in his life and make his life better. Because and I feel like kind of that's the point of the sort of the I think it's sort of the point of the movie, because I was sitting there thinking, gun to your head, what would you do all the way through this? Like, everybody keeps asking Jamie Foxx what he wants to do, and he's like, I want to start this limo service that's, you know, that's got all this awesome music and takes you to paradise and all this other type of stuff, and he's got the number of the hot lady and all this other type of stuff, and he's not calling, and Tom Cruise keeps asking him, why don't you go ahead and start your business, why don't you go ahead and call the hot lady and get a date and blah blah blah, and he's just like, oh, I just want everything to be perfect, I want to make sure everything is right before I do that. And people who do that, and I'm one of these people, you know, who constantly look for that perfect setting or whatever, end up not doing things, because that's what happens to your life after a while. And, you know, after a while, you're going to be looking at yourself at 60 or 70 and going, whoa, what happened to the time? And then later on, Jamie Foxx actually says the phrase gun to your head when he's zooming through LA and everything. And I was like, I feel like somebody asked Michael Mann or the writer of this movie, whatever, you know, gun your head, what do you want to do with your life? And then they sort of patterned a movie all around that type of thing. Like, what are you going to do with your life if someone gives you, like, no choice to do it? You know, you just think, you just got to do it, you know? So that's what I love about, that's the sort of the secondary reason why I love Collateral as well.
I love this movie. It was an absolute joy to watch it again. It holds up for me. I think the thing that one of the things that Mann seems to do really, really well, not always, but mostly, is he really understands structure and how the visuals should impact the structure. So, like, this is a great script, by the way. So that's you know, start number one. And I guess the guy who wrote it in college and then just kept refining it over the years and had a friend who finally encouraged him to turn it in. So you can tell it's, like, been, like, really refined and fine-tuned, because the structure in this is lots of setups and payoffs. You know, Jeremy, I think you used the phrase, this will be important later.
Yeah.
This is kind of, that could be the subtitle of the movie, Collateral. Yeah. This will be important later. because there's just so much great setup and payoff in the structure, and it's and nothing feels wasted. I love the technical way Mann shoots some of the stuff, especially in that final chase. There are some shots with faces in the foreground that are just evocative in a way that a lot of filmmakers don't use. And there's also a shot, again, with a face in the foreground. It's Tom Cruise's giant face, and you've got the lights of the subway behind him. It's just this beautiful shot. Mm-hmm. And Mann is always looking for that stuff, I think, and using it well. And I don't think lingers on it too much either.
One of the best shot city skyline shots of LA I've ever seen in this movie. When they're on the car driving on that highway and you see it into the right side and everything, is unbelievable. Mann also does that stuff that I like too, where he films behind the head of somebody who's looking off into the distance. He does that in almost everything. Even Ferrari recently, he did that. So it was just you can always tell it's a Michael Mann movie when you see the choices and the angles and everything. Yeah, that's good.
I also like there's the way he frames the driving shots where Jamie Foxx is driving and Tom Cruise is in the vehicle. Cruise is to the left of the driver. You do not see people shoot car scenes like this. They put the person in the middle of the back seat so that they can be seen in a regular, like, rearview mirror kind of shot. And what that does is it gives this, like, sinister feel to everything Tom Cruise says to him, because he's completely out of his sight. He's sitting right behind him, and it just feels a little off. Just like stuff like that just really builds the tension, I think, in the feel of this movie. Just a few things that I noticed this time through. I also wonder why we haven't had a Collateral sequel with Jason Statham. It's perfect. It's right there. We know he's in this somehow, and that would be amazing.
And he makes franchises that are just like this constantly. Like, this is his
right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And although, like you said, Jamie Foxx has a lot of unanswered questions. So Jamie Foxx could be in it again, and this time Statham is the one that's driving him around. So
yeah. All right, it's time for our super secret double feature.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Do you have more? I have more than one in case you want to go first, just in case.
I have one, but I did come up with a couple others.
So. Okay, all right. I'll go ahead and go. I went with Drive. I think this is I pondered Baby Driver because that character is a little more innocent in like getting pulled into something like Jamie Foxx is. Mm-hmm. But Drive has the better tone match and the better theme match, I think, with what's going on in Collateral. And it feels like a series of connections and falling deeper into this hole, even though Gosling's character from the beginning is doing side work that's like this. He still feels caught up in a way that I feel in Collateral as well. So Drive felt like a good double feature, kind of felt the same, and also has that city nightlife kind of thing going for it too. So yeah.
I like it.
Mine is going to be Falling Down. And mainly just because of the LA connection and the, you know, how LA is a character in the movie, and you have, Falling Down probably should be a big recommend one day. It's one of those, Michael Douglas going through and basically just, this is like a man's just like, I've had it with everything about the world, and LA is a perfect representation of it. Type of thing going on. I think it would go well with this movie. So that's the one that I thought. So
I like it.
Okay. All right. Well, that means next week's movie, it's on me again. And so I'm going back to my comedies of the decade thing. And I thought a long time on this one. I didn't know where I wanted to go. I feel like we started this podcast to bring you movies that you maybe haven't seen before. And that's sort of the gist of it. And through the first few of these decades here, I'm not as well versed in those decades. So a lot of the times it came down to movies that were popular back in the day. Now that we're hitting the 70s, there's a whole bunch more to choose from that I have seen and that I have to struggle over. And it's going to get worse and worse as it gets into the 80s, 90s, and aughts and everything else, because I'm going to have so many to choose from at that point. So I debated between Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, but I thought that those have had their due. I thought of a lot of Woody Allen stuff, but I felt like half the audience wouldn't want to watch a Woody Allen movie. So I didn't want to do that. I'm not afraid to recommend a Woody Allen movie, but at the same time, I want kind of everybody to be in on it. So
we did Match Point, I think, while you were gone. Here. Yeah.
A few months ago, we did
Match Point. Oh yeah. Match Point. No, I was not here for that. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a good one.
It is.
So I'm going to go to the well of Peter Sellers and recommend Being There from 1979. This movie is absolutely fantastic. It's so unusual. You will not be able to forget this afterwards, but Peter Sellers plays a person who is so simple in his thoughts that people think that he is saying very profound things, and he gets in with just the right crowd, not that he's looking for this, and says some of these things that make him appear like he's ready to be like a serious politician and heavy player. And people keep pushing him towards that goal that he has absolutely no idea that's what is happening. He is so simple in his thoughts that he has absolutely no idea what's going on around him, really. And so this is a great, great movie to discuss it. But yes, I saw also The Jerk thrown into the, that was another one that I thought of, but The Jerk is also another movie I feel like a lot of people know and have seen, and it's gotten its due, and I would love to do The Jerk, but this time we're going to do something that's kind of a dark comedy, kind of a satire. It'll be interesting to discuss this one.
This is in my list of shame, so thank you for helping me tick that box. I'm looking forward to seeing it from.
Yes, and I also thought of Kentucky Fried Movie for this, which is, you know, the only reason I didn't do that is just because there are a couple scenes. There's actually a couple scenes in a lot of these movies that I just named. I just don't know. We're at a point where it's like, I'm not afraid to recommend some of these movies, but at the same time, it's just, let's do something like this that's got maybe a couple of offensive things in it, and not so stark and in your face.
It looks like this movie is free on YouTube with ads. Which is a nice change of pace. You can also rent it from all your usual places, but I just pulled it up on YouTube and started playing it, and working just fine. So
I guess we got time for a question or two.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
I guess we've got time for a question or two. Famous last words. Let's say you are offered to do a show where you explore a country or culture with a celebrity co-host. Where are you going? And with whom, and why is Jeremy going to Italy with Justin Timberlake? I might have said that I want to be friends with Justin Timberlake one too many times over the years. And that may not be something people want to hear anymore lately.
Would like to tour Sweden with Stellan Skarsgård.
That's good.
I feel like he probably knows the place pretty well by this point.
I would think so.
Mm-hmm. In that same vein, I am having Peter Jackson take me around New Zealand, show me all the sights and all the peoples.
Yeah, yeah.
I talked to my wife about going to visit New Zealand, and she looked it up on a map, and it was too tiny.
Wait, I'm very confused right now. What do you mean too tiny?
It's too small. It's too small.
But what does that? How does that impact wanting to go there?
It feels like she might be swallowed if she went there.
Got it. Okay. All right. Yep.
It's so tiny, far away from land.
Looks like in the chat we've got, let's see, Australia with Sam Neill, Hugh Jackman, Australia, Austria with Daniel Brühl. And then Togobot says, I would go around Sweden, but with Rebecca Ferguson. Good call. Very good call. Yeah, absolutely. England with Kenneth Branagh would be on there. So, yeah, absolutely.
I got two answers. If you trace my lineage back, it's like Scottish and French Canadian. So I would go to Scotland with Ewan McGregor. He has already done a couple of motorcycle based travel documentary shows, so I think he would be really into this. But then I also remembered I really like food, so maybe I would go to Japan with a cuisine expert like Masaharu Morimoto of Iron Chef fame to get a cuisine-based tour of that culture. I like all of our vacation ideas. Why don't we turn that into a show? Why don't we do that? I'll call Timberlake.
I've got
you call Skarsgård.
I'll let Peter Jackson know.
Let's do another one. Name a movie that was ruined by a bad ending And name a bad movie saved by a good ending. Oh, wow.
I don't know if the bad ending ruined these movies, but they certainly left you coming out of the theater going, I liked everything else. The Departed, of course, has one of the all-time like endings where you're like, by the time everybody's getting shot at the end, and then Wahlberg shoots Damon and the rat shows up on the balcony, you're laughing your ass. I laughed my ass off with all these people getting shot. It's like you were expecting everyone to get shot. That's how ridiculous it was at the end. And Unbreakable has that just very abrupt, like after Sam Jackson like does that whole like reveal and everything, and it's like, da-na-na, there's the text. This is what happened to your characters. Goodbye. Thank you for coming to this movie.
We ran out of film.
Yeah, exactly. As far as bad movie with a good ending, these are harder because I don't watch as many bad movies, and I don't really think many of them get saved by a good ending. But I thought New Mutants was one of these movies. I didn't like New Mutants all the way through until Anya Taylor-Joy started kicking all the ass at the end of the
movie. Totally agree. Totally agree.
So that was pretty much, I was like, whoa, did I like this movie? Nah, I didn't like it.
Which movie?
But that ending was good. What?
Which movie?
New Mutants.
Oh, yeah. I actually liked that movie more than most people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that movie's weird. Weirdly messy, yeah. But likable. Likeable and weirdly messy. Aaron?
For good movie with a bad ending, Wonder Woman is what I went. Yeah. I was loving that movie, and then the end just went, it almost is like the end just threw its hands up and was like, I guess we're a superhero movie and this is what we do. You know, and it's just like, all right, but that's kind of boring and typical. So that would be my answer for that. As far as a good movie with a bad ending, I would like to associate myself with the remarks of the gentleman in the red shirt, which is Chris. This is really hard for me because I don't think it saves the movie. I couldn't think of a movie where a great ending saved what was already a bad movie. Because oftentimes in my brain, if the ending's great and it changes the rest of the movie, it's a good movie. It's not a bad movie with a good ending. But I went with Anchorman 2. I didn't really enjoy Anchorman 2, but that ending had me rolling. And just cameo after cameo after cameo showing up and just ultimate madness at the end. I just love
that. That is great. The only thing I didn't like, I didn't like Anchorman 2 in general, but...
No, me either.
The only thing about that ending... is A, it's of course derivative of the first movie. I mean, they may just be like, hey, let's just go balls to the wall here. But then the other part of it is all of those actors are clearly like shot on different days and everything, and they're not interacting with each other.
Yes.
And I hate that there's not a interaction with all those stars at the end. But yes, that is a fun like way to end that movie.
Yeah.
I think I've gone on record before about how much I hate the ending of Eyes Wide Shut, and how, despite how bizarre that journey is, it hooks me and pulls me in, and I'm right there with him all the way up until the end, and it just kills it for me. Again, I agree with both of you. I'm not sure there's a bad movie that has an ending good enough to actually save the whole movie. But Bodies, Bodies, Bodies was one where about three-fourths of the way through the movie, I was like, I am so sick of this fucking shit. It is so much like everything I've seen before. Yes, this generation seems to be too obsessed with their phones and their blogs, and the people are entitled. But then there's a thing that happens, and it's a new enough movie, I don't really want to get too into it, but there's a thing that happens that casts everything in a brand new light that had me rolling. It's almost worth watching just for that, although I don't think it makes the movie good. So there you go. All right, nice. I think that's gonna do it. You want to wrap us up, Chris?
All right, well, that'll do it for this week. Next week will be Being There. Who's not gonna be there? Aaron's not gonna be there.
That's right.
Wah, wah.
Man hooky,
exactly. So yeah, he's off doing important movie critic things. So,
but he will supply us with his pick for the following episode so that we can give you your homework at the end.
Yes.
Yes, he will. But again, thanks a lot, chat, for showing up and watching us today. We appreciate you so much for coming out and doing that and supporting us. So anyway, that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next week. See ya.
And one other thing, next week we'll be at 11 a.m., not 11:15. We are moving the start time of the broadcast.
That's right.
To 11 a.m. So we'll see you at 11 a.m. Next week.
We'll see a few of you at 11:15 who don't get the memo or forget and then come in partway through the show.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, yes, we will be here a little bit earlier next week. So anyway, that'll do it for this week. We'll see you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
She went backstage for the rest of the show and then left a few minutes before it ended. But The View and most of the internet decided she left right then and there because she didn't like that joke. And like The View was telling her, just smile and accept the joke. This is why I tweeted last night. She has no control over when the cameras cut to her. It's not her freaking fault. You're basically saying it's evil that she's famous and she just wants to watch her boyfriend play ball. Not her fault. She's a megastar and the cameras are going to cut to her all the time. I imagine she's really tired of hearing about it.
Oh yeah.
I didn't watch the Globes. I'm not as morally opposed to them anymore now that they cut the, you know, Hollywood foreign press out of the equation, supposedly. Yeah. We'll see. But the meme that has come from it that I love the most is the Jennifer Lawrence one. I don't know if you mentioned this one.
Oh yeah.
Where it cuts to her during her nomination, like the, you know, how they do all the nominees and it cuts to them before the awards give it out. And she mouths very clearly, if I don't win this, I'm leaving. And she goes like this.
It's like in The Running Man where Richard Dawson's like, sorry, we're experiencing technical difficulties. And the old lady's like, bullshit.
Pull the strings.
Yes, the puppet is weeping, but you yourself are not weeping.
What were you saying when my audio cut out? I was curious to hear your thoughts on the Michigan thing.
I was going to ask you, that Michigan was spying on other teams. Is that what happened?
So they had a guy, somebody on, like one of the lower level guys named Connor Stallions would buy tickets for other teams' games. And he would buy tickets specifically across from their sidelines and then videotape, you know, their signals and the plays that were happening, which is technically illegal. So.
Yeah.
Although that will probably change.
Although, like, just general game film would tell you a lot, wouldn't it? It wouldn't tell you everything, maybe.
That's the thing. Like, and so then people are like, well, you know, Jim Harbaugh knew about it because he's standing next to him and tells him, you know, the signs, and then they, you know, run a play. Well, that's what every team has this person who is supposed to try to figure out what the signs are and tell them to the coach. But they're not supposed to go to other games.
They don't even do signs, do they? Don't they call it in over a microphone?
That's the rule that's going to change. They're not allowed to have headsets in college football. So they're going to change that. So it seems to me, I will be surprised if the NCAA does anything other than like a little hand slap or anything. I highly doubt they'll negate the season or the championship.
I don't watch
or anything
of college football, so they have to turn and look at the sideline and they get like a base stealing sign every time.
Yeah,
oh my god,
yeah,
that seems ripe for danger. Yeah,
why you'll see these like very intricate posters that they hold up a lot of times. It'll be like three eyeballs and like
oh my god,
hieroglyphics. It was fun though. It's been many years, and that is a great college football team. They are a pretty incredible team. So it was fun to watch them.
Say so. You think Harbaugh's going to the NFL now?
I do, but I wouldn't be surprised if he stayed. there's a rumor going around that he and J.J. McCarthy are going to stay and run it back. But that's probably just wishful thinking for Michigan fans.
Well, and you really have to hope for a lot of things to just go right.
Especially with their schedule next year. They have a crazy hard schedule next year.
So the reason for him to go pro would be a huge payday, right?
Yes.
Like he went pro and failed and then got a huge payday to go to Michigan. And now assume the success there will get him an even bigger payday in the NFL?
Yes.
Is that how it works?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he wants to win a Super Bowl. I mean, you know, for him, I think for him, it's also the competition, too. Like, you know, he likes to win. I thought you were talking about McCarthy at first, but.
How many college coaches have gone to the NFL besides the Seattle guy and super succeeded?
Pete Carroll's really the only one that I can think of right off the top of my
head. He's kind of an anomaly in that regard.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for just being the legend and just, you know, living out your days being the legend and drawing millions of dollars every year to coach football, but you know, whatever.
I mean, I think what happens
But Harbaugh's already had success. That's the thing about him. He went to a Super Bowl.
Yes.
So
yeah.
Once you get to a certain level of wealth, it's not enough anymore. People just want more.
Well, it's just, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't want to leave the impression that we didn't realize that Harbaugh went to a freaking Super Bowl in 49.
Yes.